Welcome to the Thesis Driven Leader Series. I'm Brad Hargraves, the host of the Leader Series and the editor of Thesis Driven, and we have a really exciting show for you today featuring Dan Doktoroff. As you know, we talk a lot about the future of cities on Thesis Driven. We write a lot about the future of cities. And today, we're going to be speaking with someone who knows more about the intersection of tech and cities and how cities get built at the largest scales than Dan Doktoroff. Very few people know more than he does. He got his start thinking about cities in 1994 when he was inspired to figure out how to get the Olympics to be hosted in New York. So he joined up with the city and led New York's bid for the 2012 Olympics, which involved thinking of a lot of big projects here in the city and how those would come to pass. Now, as we all know, New York didn't win their 2012 Olympic bid, but Doktoroff ended up joining up with the Bloomberg administration to build a lot of the things that he was originally planning. And those included the new Yankee Stadium, City Field, the Barclays Center, and even really interesting projects like the High Line on Manhattan's West Side that get a lot of acclaim today. So he's perhaps the most important, certainly non-elected figure in how New York City works and looks today. Now, in 2015, he decided to do something quite different and joined up with Alphabet, which is Google's parent company, to launch Sidewalk Labs, which had a really unique vision of crafting the city of the future using technology. And they worked on some pretty compelling projects here in New York, putting Wi-Fi kiosks on the street. But their vision was to build this city of the future, which they tried to do in Toronto. That would be smart, use all kinds of data, and be much more energy efficient. Now, that ultimately didn't get built, and we're going to talk about why it didn't get built and some of his learnings. But we're really excited to dive in with Dan and explore the future of the city, the future of cities, the role technology is going to play in that, and how that informs how developers and operators should be approaching their businesses. Let's get started. So Dan, thank you so much for being on the Thesis Driven podcast and video series. Really excited to have you on the show.
Great. I'm glad to be here.
Great. Let's talk a little bit about your background. I don't think many people understand this, but I want to hear a bit about how you got into playing such a major role in New York City. I mean, you look at your early career, you had, I think a lot of people would say a very traditional arc through banking, private equity, and then suddenly you're running New York City's Olympic bid and leading some of the biggest development projects in New York City. Tell us a little bit about that moment, that shift in your career.
Well, in 1994, I went to a World Cup game, the semifinal game at the Meadowlands, and it was Italy versus Bulgaria. I hated soccer. A friend dragged me there, and I had very low expectations. And I walked into the stadium, and it was immediately apparent that it was the most exciting event that I'd ever been to. Yeah, the fans were had their flags waving, their faces painted, their bodies painted. You couldn't sit down the entire game. And what I realized was in New York, you could play that game with any two countries in the world, and every team would be able to fill the stadium with hometown fans. And so I stood there thinking, why is New York the most international city, certainly the most open city in the world, never hosted the Olympics? So I walked out of the stadium that day with this vague notion that New York could host the Olympics. And I didn't drop it. For the next year and a half, I tried to understand everything about what a city needed to do to host the Olympics. I tried to understand sporting events, but more importantly, I studied past Olympic host cities. And I had a realization that the Olympics could be a catalyst for things that the city had wanted to do for sometimes generations, but the deadlines that the Olympic bidding and hosting could create were unique in a city's life. And so I thought about the Olympics and the Olympic bid as a catalyst for real city change. And I brought on a team of experts in the city, because I didn't really know much about the city. And we developed a plan. And that plan was presented to Mike Bloomberg before he thought about running for mayor. And he adopted a bunch of the ideas. And then when he was surprisingly elected, he asked me to become deputy mayor for economic development and rebuilding. And I turned him down twice, but he finally convinced me, and it was the best experience I've ever had.
That's amazing. So I didn't realize the arc started that early in the mid-90s. I mean, the city was in a very different place back then. You know, you didn't have, you know, the wave of economic development that you have today.
No, we started when we really entered City Hall, but we had a plan going into City Hall because I had started the Olympic bid.
So then you move into the city. You become deputy mayor of economic development, and you tackle a number of projects that today are major parts of what makes New York City, New York City. So we're talking about, you know, the High Line, the Barclays Center, the new Yankee Stadium. So what from that period are you most proud of and why?
Well, what I'm most proud of is the comprehensive nature of what we did. It wasn't any one project. You know, we rebuilt the World Trade Center site.
Right.
We rebuilt, built Hudson Yards. But we also thought about diversifying the economy, both geographically and also diversifying it by industry. New York was heavily dependent on finance. And not only did we really encourage finance, but film and television production, tourism, life sciences, tech, and we also diversified it geographically. So in the Bloomberg years, businesses grew, new business formation grew 48% in Brooklyn, 33% in Queens, you know, 20-something percent in the Bronx, double digits in Staten Island, and it actually went down 2% in Manhattan. And we developed all these new locations like Long Island City, downtown Brooklyn, the Greenpoint, Williamsburg, waterfront, Jamaica, Flushing, Harlem, the South Bronx. So New York is a very different place than it was before we came in.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people, especially people who are a little younger, haven't been in New York for as long, recognize this and how much it has changed. You know, not just over the past 40 years. I mean, yeah, obviously we've come a long way from the Bronx's burning days, but have changed from the mid-2000s. You know, I started a tech company in New York in the mid-2000s, and there wasn't a tech ecosystem. You know, the New York tech meetup was 100 people who met at IAC every month. And there weren't co-working spaces. When we started General Assembly in 2010, we got a grant from the EDC under Bloomberg for co-working spaces because there weren't enough places for companies to get started. Now, people look at it and they're like, why was the city giving away grants for co-working spaces? Well, it didn't exist in 2010. That ecosystem was not, it was not there. So it's been a complete transformation.
Yeah. Tech particularly, you know, I started, but my successors, Bob Steele, Seth Pinsky, who ran the Econep Development Corporation, were the real champions. And they, for example, did Cornell Tech, which has had a major impact. But what we did do in my tenure was improve quality of life dramatically, and that encouraged companies like Google to establish a base in New York, Amazon, Facebook, and we created over time an ecosystem that has been remarkably successful. So, you know, at the end of the day, what you really care about is improving quality of life in every dimension. Most importantly, safety, but education, healthcare, things to do, the environment. And in fact, what I'm most proud of in my tenure in City Hall was a thing called Plan YC, which looked out 25 years and planned for another 1 billion people, but also reduced during the Bloomberg era carbon emissions by nearly 20%. So that initiative included rebuilding new parks that had never been completed, the million trees, the hybrid taxis, and infrastructure projects, the largest brownfields remediation program outside of California. And it was 127 initiatives, of which we did 125. And one of the ones that we didn't get done was congestion pricing, which now, 17 years later, is going to be implemented. So, we were in a hurry, and I think we had a profound impact on New York.
So let's talk a bit. So it's been a huge transformation, but there's also been, to varying degrees, a backlash to that transformation. So I want to talk a little bit about that. We had Marianne Gilmartin on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. She's obviously, you know, one of the most prominent developers in New York City. She's done some incredible projects. from kind of the other side of the table from you. And she really lamented the anti-development sentiment in New York that has gathered over the past, say, you know, 5 to 10 years, but, you know, culminating perhaps in chasing away Amazon HQ2, making it increasingly hard to get things through ULURP. What's your take on the anti-development sentiment in New York? Do you think it's as big of an issue as she does? And where do you think it comes from?
I think it's moving back. The pendulum is starting to swing back to pro-development, because the biggest issue we have in New York is a lack of housing. Post the financial crisis, the population continued to grow. The jobs numbers continue to grow, but financing of real estate, particularly residential real estate, for a period of time was very difficult. And so we got out of whack in terms of supply and demand, and housing prices increased. We have to correct that. That's the biggest problem. Migrants are a separate issue that we have in New York. I co-authored a report for the governor and mayor last year called the New York Report. And we called for 500,000 units of housing over the next decade. That is very doable, but we're going to have to convince the population and the communities in which we need to primarily have transit-oriented development that we need this to lower housing costs. And that requires effective communication, but I do think the pendulum is swinging back somewhat.
I hope you're right. Obviously, I was disappointed by the failure last year of the governor, the assembly, to get any meaningful housing reform through. I believe today, as we record this in early January, is the first day of the new legislative session in Albany. So I'm hopeful they'll get something done. I don't want to say I'm bullish, but I'm hopeful.
I am too. The governor is really committed to increasing the housing. I think Mayor Adams is too. Maria Torres Springer, who worked for me in City Hall and is now the deputy mayor for housing, economic and workforce development, I think is really committed to getting those 500,000 units. And I think we'll eventually get there in terms of the legislation that's needed to set the conditions that we need.
I mean, I think one thing you have seen, one pendulum swinging back in that direction, you have seen over the past 24 to 36 months, are more reforms that are passing to enable more housing development outside of New York. You know, you saw a raft of regulatory change in California, making it easier to build. You saw even Montana saying you can build triplexes, fourplexes on any lot. Various counties have enacted similar legislation. I mean, what's your take on, do you see that as a broader macro movement away from restrictive zoning?
Totally. Because everywhere in the U.S., where people want to live, housing prices have increased, and people eventually will realize the way to deal with it is relieving the supply and demand imbalance. And it's just a matter of time and communication and specific plans. That's what we did. Now, we were helped by 9/11. You know, 9/11 for New Yorkers was a catalyst. And it was New Yorkers wanted to rebuild the city and make it, as the title of my book, greater than ever. And we capitalized on that. But we're in a similar situation now, post-COVID, with all the issues of return to work. And we can capitalize on that and make the case that we need to grow and we can do it carefully in context of local communities, have it be more transit-oriented development. And I think we'll get there.
So, you know, talked about remote work, talked about housing. You know, just to wrap up our conversation about New York before we move into talking about technology and sidewalk labs, where I'd like to spend some time. What do you think the greatest threat that New York faces today is?
Well, I think the migrant crisis is a temporary threat. And I think there are solutions to it. We've got to get the migrants to work faster. I think, by the way, facing budget crises, that we should probably have the migrants who are paying for because of the right to house. We should put them to work, cleaning up the city. And we can probably, if we register them, get them to be able to work faster, get them to work for the city, we may be able to cut down the period of time that we need to house them. But the longer term crisis, as we talked about, is housing. And we've addressed it. We just got to produce more. And we can't. There was a op-ed last week in the New York Times by former colleague of mine in city government, Vishan Chakrabarty. And I would encourage people to look at it. He said we can produce 513,000 units of housing. That houses more than a million people within the context of neighborhoods, focused on transit-oriented development, not violating any historic districts. And we just have to be very specific and driven to get it done and communicate effectively. That's the biggest problem we have. The high costs of living in New York, which is largely driven by housing costs, will dissuade potential employers from coming here. And we don't want that to happen. But more importantly, we want everybody to be able to live here without spending, you know, 40-50% of their income on housing. We've got to lower the cost.
So, I mean, these are two related challenges, just and then we're going to move on to technology. These are two related challenges. I mean, the migrant crisis, one of the things that makes it a challenge is there's not enough housing stock in the city. there are not enough rooms, whether it's SRO rooms, hotel rooms, vacant units to put the migrants in. One of my favorite data points, peak, we have 600 migrants a day coming today. It's a lot, 600 migrants a day. But in the early 20th century at Ellis Island, we had 10,000 a day.
Right. And by the way, in 2016, before the Trump administration, we had 160,000 immigrants coming to New York a year. Absent the migrants, that number is significantly lower. So we can absorb people. And by the way, not all migrants stay in New York. Once they get the right to work, they move other places. There's 68,000 migrants in the shelter system now, but we've let in well over 100,000 over the last year. So they go other places. Typically, you know, what we've seen with immigrants to New York is over time, a third settle in New York, a third settle in the outlying areas, the metro area, and third goes somewhere else. So we can accommodate the immigrants, and immigrants really power our economy. So I do not worry about our ability to assimilate them because, you know, the immigrants are ultimately the greatest optimists in the world. Look at what these people have gone through just to get to the United States. They are the ultimate, as I said, optimists. And that's what has fueled New York. New York is the most optimistic place on the planet because when you're an immigrant, you have to believe that where you're going is better than the place you've grown up and the place you knew. And being a city of immigrants, roughly 40% of us are immigrants, another 25% are children of immigrants. And people like me, came from other parts of the U.S. So 80% of us have that immigrant root, and we bring together a group of optimists. Anything can be done. And I just believe that. I've always believed it. And that's what's made New York great. It creates the energy. That's the first word anybody uses to describe New York. And with tapping that energy, we can overcome anything.
So I want to move for a moment to talk about Sidewalk and talk about the role of technology in cities. So you started Sidewalk Labs, partnership with Alphabet. At the time, Google was pre-Alphabet, right, when you started it? Yeah. So initially a partnership with Google, Alphabet, done a lot of things from spinning out products, working with New York on Link NYC, working with Toronto, or get to that in a minute. But help me understand, what was the overarching, if there was a thesis to Sidewalk Labs, what was that thesis?
It was two parts. The initial conception was we're going to create the most innovative district in the world to demonstrate what the power of technology in cities could be. But as we were thinking about what that place would be, we also were to develop products and services that could serve cities. And we did that very successfully. We didn't manage to get the project done in Toronto, but a lot of other people who want to build cities are using the work that we did.
I want to talk a bit about that work and, you know, some of the other folks building new cities, but maybe let's talk a bit about the Toronto project, since, you know, we're there. You know, it was designed in Toronto's Quayside neighborhood to really transform this part of the city into something that was the most tech forward neighborhood in the world, certainly in the world outside of East Asia. What happened? Why do you think it went off the rails?
Well, we withdrew. Ultimately, we had a deal. And by the way, the process of getting that deal was incredibly contentious.
You mean with the city?
Well, with certain members of the public, and the city, we made a mistake. We should have gone to a city that had a strong mayor form of government, because we were dealing with an entity that was called Waterfront Toronto, that was reported to the city, the province, and the federal government, which made it very complicated. The city, running without a strong mayor form of government, there was nobody to really drive it. When we came in, we were very aligned with the city, the province, and the federal government. The province had an election, and the conservative was elected and took him time to be won over. The federal government, Justin Trudeau, went from a majority government to a minority government. All that made things much more complicated. And, you know, if we'd done it in the South, in the U.S., it would have been much simpler. The land was amazing, but what we also found was that certain people, and they raised their voices very loudly, didn't want an American company to come in and tell Torontonians what to do. But we ended up getting through all that, reached a deal, and then COVID hit, and the economics were, you know, uncertain. But more importantly, we felt like we weren't getting the cooperation of the bureaucracy fast enough to be truly innovative, and we were going to have to really compromise on innovation. And what we didn't want to do was just have a mediocre development like the condos that had been developed on the waterfront. We had to do something special.
Yeah.
So all those factors played a role in our withdrawal. But out of it came a lot of really exciting companies.
Well, I want to touch on that, because, you know, we've done a few pieces at Thesis Driven about people building new cities and about this movement that you're seeing more entrepreneurs. And you know, there's varying examples across the spectrum. One person we're going to have on the podcast in a few weeks is Jan Sramek, who is the entrepreneur behind California Forever, trying to build a city in Solano County, California. We also interviewed Casey Roloff, who built Seabrook, Washington, which is more of a new urbanist vacation town. So a little bit different than what you were doing in Toronto. But would love to hear your advice for people who are going out and building a city from scratch, because we're meeting more of these people. We're seeing more of them than at least I ever have before.
Well, the first thing people should do is go to the document that we wrote and presented to the three governments in Canada. We called it the Master Innovation and Development Plan. It was literally 1,500 pages. And we outlined all the innovations, the physical layout of the plan of the district. And that is the most effective roadmap that anyone's ever done to describe how urbanity and technology can come together, and this is really important, to improve every dimension of quality of life. So in this district, we were going to be carbon positive. We were going to reduce the number of cars dramatically. We were going to have all mass timber construction, which would have reduced embedded carbon by over 80%. And there were a whole host of other data, social and physical infrastructure approaches that were revolutionary. So I would take a look at that for anyone who wants to build something that is really different but improves quality of life. And by the way, while privacy was a big topic, you know, we eventually agreed with government of Toronto on a very, I think, forward-looking approach to managing privacy in public space. And I would encourage people to look at that as well. Because if you want to use data, you have to have the community bought in. And eventually we did.
Yeah. You looking at something like what, you know, Sramek is doing in Solano County, building a new city from scratch, you know, he's got some big Silicon Valley investors behind him, you know, gearing up for a big referendum this year across the county of whether he can do it or not. Do you think that's a good thing? Do you think that's a good thing that entrepreneurs are going out and saying, hey, we're going to build a city from scratch in this location?
I think it can be, but it depends on what they want to do. You know, our goal was to set an example for cities around the world by employing all these new technologies. You know, building a community without any real advantage to the world, you know, it's a real estate project.
Right.
So, you know, our goals were much loftier than many.
So I want to talk a little bit, maybe get a little philosophical here. One thing a lot of polls have showed recently is just declining institutional trust. People don't trust. I'm not just talking about Congress and the federal government. I'm talking about really any organization, institution that is coming in and saying, hey, we're going to do this. We're going to do this thing. You know, what role do you think declining institutional trust, do you think it's playing a role in making development and projects like what you were trying to do in Toronto harder?
It's absolutely. But I'm always a believer in storytelling. Storytelling, vision with substance. And I do believe that you can overcome lots of objections with a powerful vision and real substance behind it. Not to say it always works, but you got to do the homework. And that's what we did in New York. We always did the homework and convinced people I think we had 300 or so initiatives. We only didn't do like 5 of them. And the reason was because we convinced the population that this was good for New York. When I look back on our experience, I think most New Yorkers would feel that the Bloomberg era was real positive, not unalloyed positive, because, obviously things got more expensive. But overall, in terms of diversifying the economy creating new places, new parks, preparing the city for growth in terms of infrastructure, I think people would generally agree that it was a positive thing. And underlying that, you had to have a plan, and you had to convince people that that plan was consistent with their objectives and desires and dreams for New York. And that's true in any place. But look, we are at a moment in time where I would probably say we are more divided, more polarized than any time before the Civil War, than any time since before the Civil War. And we have to start bringing people together. The political parties aren't doing that.
Right. I mean, we talked a little bit about new cities. Looking at existing cities today, which ones do you think are doing it right? I mean, obviously, New York, mid-2000s, got a lot of things right. What are the cities you think are doing it right now in 2023?
There's no one city that you can look at as a paragon of what to do well. And cities like Barcelona, I think, are do well. Paris, in the inside of Paris, but not the suburbs at all. But there are cities that innovate. Mexico City has innovated. Bogota, Colombia, with their aerial tram. There's a lot of places that are innovating, both in infrastructure, social infrastructure, digital infrastructure, but no one place has put it all together. That was why we thought it was so important to do what we did in Toronto, to serve as a model, but also to experiment and see what works and what doesn't. And we need places like that to show what can be possible. You know, cities copy each other. And if they see something that's successful, they will copy it. Bike share is a good example of that. The High Line, you know, we created the High Line. And within a year, there were 35 other projects that use old infrastructure to create parks. So serving as an example is really important.
So I love the High Line. I live about two blocks away from it. It's an awesome piece of urban infrastructure. Often copied, never perfectly done. So I want to talk, we've talked a lot about technology in the abstract. I mean, it's core to what we talk about here at Thesis Driven is, you know, the role of technology in the built world. But if you're thinking about specific technologies that are going to have the biggest impact on the built world in 10 years, you know, what comes to your mind of the technologies we're going to be talking about in 10 years that have had an impact or having an impact on the built environment?
So I'd say one of the most important, we've referenced this before, is mass timber construction. Because, you know, buildings are responsible in major cities for like 70% of carbon emissions. And we need to dramatically reduce the carbon emissions from building. Now, a lot of that is the energy that powers them, which is shifting. But I love mass timber building. They're gaining more credibility worldwide. Again, if we'd been able to do a whole district in Toronto, we would have shown the world what the benefits would have been. So I love mass timber building.
What are the barriers to bigger adoption of mass timber? I mean, do the fire codes need to catch up? I mean, what's the issue?
Actually, having a wood structure, there may be some concrete or steel involved, is actually safer than a steel, and about the same. So, but it's regulatory. You know, regulatory bodies in cities are very slow to change. And you need to really, as I said, do the homework and prepare regulatory bodies to adopt new approaches. You know, we're doing it in New York, out of Play NYC, eventually came Local Law 97, which will force buildings to refashion the way they use energy. And so, you know, people need examples. That is why, you know, in New York, with Plan YC, and it's 127 initiatives, we thought it could serve, because New York's so visible, as a model for the world. And really, it kind of has.
Yeah.
So you just need examples and models.
So last question before we move into the lightning round. A lot of your time, you stepped down from Sidewalk. A lot of your time since then has been dedicated to focusing on supporting research, combating ALS, which is obviously very close to your heart. Would love to hear more about that and some of the efforts you're backing.
So 11 years ago, after my father and uncle died of ALS, I decided, it's probably hereditary in my family, and I had to do something. So I brought together a team of scientists to understand why there had been so little progress in ALS research since the disease had been discovered in 1870.
Wow.
So it was like 140 plus years. And they came back with a series of hypotheses related to the soloization of research, the clubbiness of the way research was funded, the lack of tools and resources that researchers needed, which created big barriers to entry to getting into the disease, the lack of industry involved in ALS, IP issues, and the like. And so we built an organization called Target ALS around those, correcting for those hypotheses. And it's been remarkably successful. So we do several things. We fund consortia of researchers, often combining academics with industry. We funded before last year 59 consortia. 60% of them have led to drug development programs.
Wow.
Part of industry. 7 clinical trials have resulted from them, and 5 biotech companies have been formed. And a key part of that is we have a great independent review committee of 46 scientists that volunteer their time, really noted scientists on the cutting edge of neurodegenerative disease specialty, and they've done a magnificent job picking out of, we do open calls and targeted calls on important ALS topics, and they've done a magnificent job picking people. Second thing we do is we provide a suite of 8 scientific tools and resources, things like stem cells, animal models, tissue samples, antibodies, etc. And those we give away for free. Anyone in the world can access them. And those have been used on over 1,100 projects.
Wow.
Since we established it. And that is lowering the barriers to entry to getting new people into the field. Third thing we do is we focus on bringing industry into the ALS research field. When we started We were engaged with 8 companies. This past year, there were 138 companies.
Wow.
That we were engaged with, and that includes biotech, pharma, and venture capital. And plans to partner with other diseases, neurodegenerative diseases, because there's a lot of overlap. And ALS has increasingly become the tip of the spear. FDA is more flexible with ALS because 80% of people die within 3 to 5 years. So, yeah, there's not a lot of downside in improving potential therapies. And we partner with Alzheimer's, the Alzheimer's Drug Discovery Fund, Gates Ventures, with Fidelity's venture biotech arm. We bought the Association for Frontotemporal Degeneration. That's what Bruce Willis was just diagnosed with. And, you know, we do it to bring new people into the field, but to share discovery with other related diseases. So we have an impact, I think, beyond ALS as well. And so, you know, in October of 2021, I was diagnosed with ALS. It's my voice is so hoarse, and my right hand doesn't work. My right foot, you know, in ALS, the motor neurons in your brain and spine send signals to the muscles to move, and for a variety of reasons, both genetic and biological, those motor neurons die. And when they die, you can't move.
Right.
And ultimately you die because of respiratory failure. But you increasingly get paralyzed over time. And so when I was diagnosed, we developed for targeted ALS a strategic plan. We figured we needed $250 million to carry out our plans for the next 8 or 9 years. And I have to nail down one more donor who I'm in conversation with, and I'll be at the goal. So we're getting very close.
It's exciting. It's exciting and very powerful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And it's thank you for the awesome work you're doing there.
Yeah. Well, it was deeply personal for me.
Yes.
And by the way, 1 in 400 people will die of ALS.
1 in 400. Wow.
Yeah.
So I do want to move to the lightning round.
Okay.
Quick questions, quick answers.
Okay.
Got a few questions for you to wrap up today's show. First question, what's one piece of advice you would give a real estate developer starting up today?
Go where others ain't. Go where others, do something that other people aren't doing.
Do something different. Off the beaten path. I love it. It's the first time I've gotten that piece of advice. I'm kind of surprised. It's a good one.
You know, Mike Bloomberg always gave me advice. He said, anyone who hasn't lost is a loser. And what he meant was you got to try new things. Obviously, you have to be very focused and disciplined and in trying new things. But I've always believed that you know, people who are super successful think different, and thinking different is the key.
Next question. Tell us about one startup developer or entrepreneur you're watching really closely and why.
Well, we formed City Block Health out of Sidewalk Labs. And City Block for Medicaid and Medicare patients provides a comprehensive approach to healthcare, social, medical, and emotional care. And it's been remarkably successful. It achieved a $6 billion valuation.
Wow.
In early 2022. But what we've done is really improved for these patients the care, and also lowered the costs. So the care model is really working, and we're on a really, I think, path to real success.
If we were recording this podcast in the 2030s, what's the most important thing we're going to be talking about?
Polarization.
Yeah. All kinds. Political, primarily, you mean?
Yeah, but as you pointed out before, the resentment of elites, especially, has driven a wedge on, like, every issue. We have to bring the country back together again. I think that's the real, highest priority in our society. And by the way, it's happening in
right
everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not just the U.S.
No.
If you could change one federal, state, local, real estate related law or policy, snap of a finger, what would it be?
Yeah, I would restart 421A, which is the incentive program for housing.
Yeah, 421A is the tax abatement that basically enables any multifamily development to happen in New York City. Talked about it at length with Marianne Gilmartin a few weeks ago. Listeners are familiar with it.
Yeah.
Last question. I might know the answer to it. I might not. If you could bet on one city or place, what would it be?
New York.
Of course.
Always New York. Yeah, but I believe in New York because it's the most open city in the world. When I was bidding for the Olympics, I met a Japanese banker, and he had run his bank's branches in Paris, London, Sydney, all set of them. I said, "What's your favorite city in the world?" And he said, "You're going to laugh when I tell you this." I said, "I promise I won't laugh." He said, "It's New York, because when I walk down the street, people ask me for directions." And what that means, I laughed, what that means is you can look like anyone, you can dress like anyone. People just assume you're a New Yorker. And that openness I think is New York's greatest strength. That doesn't mean that we don't need to deal with budget issues and always improve quality of life. But if we do that, we will continue to be, I think, the leading city in the world.
Dan, thank you so much for being on the show today. Dan Doctoroff, future New York City Hall of Fame inductee, and one of the most influential people in making the city how it is today. So honored to have you on. Thanks.
Thanks, Brad.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed that conversation with Dan Doctoroff, veteran of Sidewalk Labs and building some of the greatest projects that are in New York today. Now, I hope you can join us next week as well, as we've got one of my favorite people in the prop tech world, Karen Mayo, joining us. Karen was a founder of Funnel way back in the early 2010s. Funnel is a really interesting technology that helps multifamily owners and developers fill their buildings, uses a lot of AI, a lot of new technology, and she's been around the prop tech world for quite a while and has a lot of perspectives on how great prop tech and real estate tech companies are built and how developers can add technology to their projects. So really hope you can join us next week for my chat with Karen. Thanks, and see you then.